I'm assuming you have no time, free time in your hands, hence the...
Yeah, I mean, it helps. I'm not in any relationship right now, so this is like, this is the time to do it, you know? And, yeah, and then, you know, the band's probably my longest relationship I've ever had, and it's with, you know, three other people, so it's, you know, it's good. It's a good testament to just being able to focus on one thing and kind of, you know, getting the thing off the ground. But, you know, once things change and we have a lot more going on, then it'll be a lot. But yeah, so it's cool. It's I try to find time. I honestly don't function well just laying down, not doing anything. Not that type of person. I kind of feel like I'm wasting my life pretty much. It just kind of melts away and I gotta do stuff. So I'm constantly doing a billion different things and it just makes me happy.
I'm the same way. I'm like a have 3 to 4 full-time projects kind of thing. Otherwise, I'm like, none of these projects will make it if I don't do all of them at the same time.
I know. It's, you know, life is short.
Yeah.
I think that's the best way to put it. You know, like life is too short. You gotta do as much as you can while you're on this planet. That's pretty much my whole mantra.
Hey everyone, welcome to Made for Music. I am your host, Duncan Byerjean. The reason I started this podcast was growing up, music was my ultimate passion, but I didn't know how to get started. So this podcast seeks to depict a comprehensive view of the music world, from the artistry to the business, so you can discover the resources available to you, and most importantly, the stories behind the people making things happen. If you dig what you hear, please rate and subscribe to Made for Music on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whatever your preferred podcast medium is. I truly appreciate that extra effort. Without further ado, here is the next episode of Made for Music. Welcome to Made for Music. Today's friend of the podcast made his industry debut at just 16 years old as the youngest DJ in Santa Barbara's KJEE's history. This led to an early career as a promoter, following stints as a touring crew member, a member of Conan O'Brien's music department, time as a publicist, manager, freelance A&R, and ultimately landing at Angry Mob Music in 2015, a full-services publishing firm in Los Angeles. Needless to say, this guy knows the business, but not only that, he plays guitar, bass, drums, keys, sings. You excited yet? Same. So, without further ado, please welcome the co-lead vocalist and guitarist of Cuffed Up, manager of Cape Francis, and IFS award-winning director and screenwriter, Angry Mob's senior director of A&R, Ralph Torrefranca.
Wow, that was an insanely amazing preamble. Thank you so much.
It was one of the most challenging ones to put together, to be honest, because I was doing my research and I was like, oh, here's an incredible thing that most people have never done. Oh, here's another one. Okay, and another.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to pick and choose. I mean, now you know how I feel whenever I have to tell people, like, so what's your background? I'm like, well, do you have an hour? Do you want to talk for an hour?
It's like we were talking about before. You're like, I have literally a project for every creative vein at this point.
Exactly, or I've dipped my toe into at least some other areas and stuff. Yeah, it's crazy.
For folks that maybe aren't familiar, A&R, Artists in Repertoire, do you mind breaking down, like, what is that?
Yeah, I mean, that definition has changed a lot over the course of where it originally came from. Obviously, it came from actual, you know, like records being created, but now it's evolved into this whole definition of just, you know, creative. A&R is equals creative. It's what people do at certain companies that are supposed to come up with certain ideas, and it's like, you know, on the label side, A&R is different than on the publishing side, right? So on A&R, on the label side, is very just like marketing heavy, numbers heavy. Obviously, they're still creative and they're coming up with these like creative ways to market an album that was finished, or like, you know, they'll set up sessions and stuff too, but it's generally just, it's a lot of just trying to sell the artist versus A&R and publishing, where, we're on the ground floor. We literally have to start off, well, the song doesn't exist. How do we make a song exist? And how do we make, you know, how does this benefit our are writers or producers or artists that helps further their career. So, you know, A&R on the publishing side is like setting up a lot of sessions. It's signing the writers and artists and the producers and making methodic and creative moves for themselves to be able to, you know, sustain in life and like make money on the back end and make money on the front end sometimes and really kind of find a find their niche in the music industry that can feel so vast and big sometimes. So we're part of the team. You know, we work directly with the managers of said writers and artists and producers. We work with their labels. We work with just everyone there. And we kind of come in as this really great resource to come up with ideas and really lay down some groundwork with what we could potentially do for them in the long run.
Like we've already alluded to, you've had your hands in so many different mm-hmm. pockets. Is that what drew you to A&R on the publishing side, is because it is so much more involved?
A&R was always like a dream job of mine in a lot of ways, but it was also a job that I didn't necessarily aim for from the beginning. So like at the beginning, I didn't even think that that was a job. I was particularly just, I wanted to be a manager. I wanted to know everything about management, and I knew I needed to know everything about the music business. But aiming for A&R was definitely like, usually A&R just comes to you. It's kind of the thing where, you know, you kind of fall into it. If you're doing a lot of work elsewhere, people start to recognize it. That's what happened with Angry Mob, was that at the time I was managing this band called Honey that was doing really well. And then because of that, the former head of A&R at Angry Mob found me and was basically like impressed by a lot of what I was doing on the side. And at the time I was the front desk person at Red Light Management. I was also doing like some day-to-day, and I was the head of internship program, but I was essentially like this Swiss Army knife of a man that just didn't see the light of day because he was working 24 hours a day almost just for the company, and it was draining. But it was you know, it was a good time to learn and get to know a lot of people. And at that time I ended up meeting Jay Sloan, and he asked me to come in, and then was like, hey, do you want to make normal amounts of money with benefits? I was like, what? And you know, a lot of people don't know this, or a lot of people assume out on the outside, they're like, oh, management must make a lot of money, blah blah blah. It's like, no, management are picking scraps up, even the biggest managers, and they're trying to, you know, pay their mortgage and do all that stuff. So naturally the people underneath them are making diddly squat. So we're, you know, we're getting paid fucking shit, and then and we're doing the most work, and we're stressed out, they're stressed out understandably, and we're all, you know, it's just like this cycle of stress that everyone is having to deal with. So, you know, when someone comes in and says, hey, I believe in your creative input, I believe that you have the ear to be an A&R, you want to do it, of course I'm going to do it. That was like a no-brainer. So I came over to Angry Mob in 2015, over 6 years ago. And then, you know, me and Jay worked together for a little bit less than a year, and then he left, and then I ended up being A&R director. I was A&R manager until he left, and I became A&R director, and then the keys was passed to me. And then it's just been, you know, it's been DNA building from the ground up of a roster that I'm super, super proud of. Like, we have such a diverse roster of all these different types of people from different types of backgrounds. Like, Love Sad Kid, who is this non-binary multiracial rapper, singer, insane top liner artist who, you know, I get to say that I work with, and I'm so proud to work with. And then you have someone else on the other spectrum, at the end of the spectrum, like Jake Scott, who like co-wrote Aloe Black's Brooklyn in the summer and is obviously like this powerhouse of a artist and one of the best writers I've ever met in my entire life. And, you know, when I met him, he only had 70,000 monthly listeners at the time, I think. And when we started working, and then he was doing the thing where he put songs out every month, and then eventually that grew. And then, you know, at the end of last year, he had 3.5 million monthly listeners. And, you know, like seeing the growth of all of these people and all these producers that maybe we only met at the beginning. Even I signed producers when no one knew who they were, but I knew that the talent was there, and I had the, you know, luckily the financial backing to be able to make these really cool and you know, investments into these people, you know, these people as people because of their talents, not because of numbers, because of certain, you know, a lot of my counterparts at other companies who I love, you know, they have to go by the books. It's a very, very like by the books. And I get it. They have, you know, they're having to please a lot of people. For us being such a small independent company, our CEO, Mark Russo, is a fucking champion. The guy just champions everything that we do. And that's why, you know, the company is where it's at. We've grown so much over the last 6 years. And it's because he's taken risks on people. He's taken risks on his staff. Like we've grown and we've, you know, stayed with him this whole time. I mean, I don't know if you know, but like 6 years at a company is a fucking long time. Like
that's especially in music.
Yeah, that does not happen. So, and there's a reason why. I've had, you know, there's been opportunities and stuff that's popped up, but like I never once was I tempted to ever leave because, you know, Angry Mob's been so, you know, so very supportive of me, of just like everything that I've done, and they support everyone else on the roster unconditionally. And we're a family. We call it the A-Mob fam, you know, because once you're family, even if you eventually leave the family and graduate or go wherever, you're always going to be family. That's just going to be it. And that's why I love about the culture at the company. And that's what sets us apart. Honestly, that's why a lot of people come to us, and we don't chase after big deals. We're not trying to fight against the big companies for so and so because they need a new publisher. We're just finding the right people that make the right sense and that fits really well in our culture. And then because of that approach, you know, that's why we've had such a great roster of really creative people that we could invest in both monetarily and emotionally. It definitely sets us apart from everyone.
I love that. What is your day-to-day? And you mentioned you kind of get to take a different approach. What are you ultimately looking for? And have you witnessed that transition from the more traditional A&R to the more research A&R?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's my job to pay attention and know about the numbers side of everything. So I know about like what's happening and what the trends are and where things seem to be going. But I'm 31 years old. Like we have this joke at work where the CEO always catches me because I talk like I'm a fucking 50-year-old or a 60-year-old, where I'm like, you know, call me a traditionalist, but I was like, I think that we need to go with our gut here. And not enough people are going by their gut anymore. Everyone is, and it's rightfully so, makes sense, because you have all the information right in front of you. Why would you do something against the information that says like, hey, there's a good chance it's not going to work, right? And the reason why I used to love the music, well, I used to love the music business, but why I fell in love with the music business was because of certain people that I met that just like went with their gut, that like, you know what, that may not necessarily make sense, but I see a potential. And then they go in for them and they just like stick by them. And it's an approach I've always had. And, you know, it's because I'm an artist myself. And I've been through the ringer. I've been a failed artist multiple times. I've seen, you know, I've seen rock bottom of like what happens when your dreams just completely fall to shit and you literally have absolutely no options. You know, like that's literally, at some point I caught myself like working a fucking hosting job at a restaurant, and I was like, what am I doing? And it took me only 2 months to realize like that's a mistake. And then I left and I dove right back in. But it's because of these types of relationships I have with my writers right now. Like if I care about you, obviously I'm gonna work my ass off. It marries into the whole approach of going with your gut, because the numbers are good and the numbers do help. And obviously we need to pay attention to the numbers, but we also need to pay attention to the people. And sadly, it's not happening. It's not happening as much as you wish it would be happening, but there's good people in the industry. So those are the people that I like working with.
I guess rewinding a tiny bit, how did that time in radio and then moving to, I guess what would be considered like an artist team side as like a publicist and manager, how did those different experiences from tastemaking to curation influence that approach?
Yeah. I mean, like the radio side's so simple, right? The song gets added, you got to service it, and then you just promote the shit out of it, and then you know they come through town, so naturally you're like, you're going to the concerts and you're like plastering the KJE logo on all and on everything. The funny thing is, like, so that used to be like one of my first jobs at the radio station, was I would go to these shows and I would literally like put the KJE logo all over the venue, because obviously it's like KJE presents whatever. And last year we were opening up for Silvers and Pickups at the Ventura Theater, where where I used to see a lot of the shows I went to watch was at the Ventura Theater, because I lived in Santa Barbara. And we were sound checking, and then I look across the room and I hear this voice, and I hear Ralph, and it's my friend Everett from KJE putting up the logo stuff.
Oh my gosh.
And then he goes, "You're up there." And I'm like, "I'm up here." It's such a surreal moment. But like, you know, radio is so much promo. It's really what it is promo. When I transitioned into being, you know, like eventually being a publicist or being on an A&R team or being being with a management company, you get to see why the radio part is so important. And that's why, like, I've held 20 different jobs in industries, because I needed to understand, like, how did it get to radio? What steps did it need to take to get to radio? And when, like, where's the birth of like the song, you know? So eventually that's what it is. And that's why I tracked all eventually, you know, I ended up in publishing, because that is literally the end of the line. And it is the beginning of the stages of where it is before, you know, eventually goes to radio or the internet or to distro, and it's publishing. So, you know, management and being part of creative teams, it was great to, you know, learn how to do everything in the in-between. And that's what it actually taught me. It was like the in-between and, you know, marketing and touring. Obviously I was touring too, but like touring and like strategy, rollouts. So like I learned how to do rollouts, and that's still one of my favorite things to help people with nowadays too, is just, you know, the rollouts, because rollouts has drastically changed, and obviously April music has changed, and I've been doing it long enough, and it makes, again, I feel like an old man, but it's true. Like I started doing this when I was 16, I'm 31 now, like the world is totally different. MySpace was, you know, when I started, and now it's a blog.
Right. You've seen the life cycle of a song from publishing to radio and what that looks like, especially those that aren't in Los Angeles, New York, Nashville. Go, I don't even know what to do. I guess I'll throw my song on Spotify, or I guess I'll go play the local bar. If you wouldn't mind sharing, I guess for someone who is like, I want to do this, do you have like, okay, you're starting with the song. What advice do you have from there?
Yeah. So this person doesn't have any interest in TikTok. This is just someone who, because that changes everything. This person is just traditionally wanting to put a song out and then just trying to become an artist, right? If it's a traditional sense of putting a song out, creatively finding a way to create buzz, you know, create mystery behind you. I think that's a big thing. A lot of people don't really put that thought into it. They just think that, you know, and of course it needs to be an amazing song, but like for people to actually listen to it, you need to get everyone around you interested. You need them to kind of really kind of rally around you. And for example, like Cuffed Up, what we did, because no one knew the fuck we were. Everyone knew us from different bands. We're all, band is from, is an amalgam of different bands. And so we took that advantage. We're like, okay, some people know us in the scene. Let's book a show at our own rehearsal space. We had like a place that could fit about 100 people in our rehearsal space. Let's announce a show. We have no music. We're going to announce the band on all of our socials, and we're going to invite everyone that we know to come to this thing. So, you know, I don't know, 80, 90 people show up to this thing. No one's heard our music at all. But we built a mystery around that. And then we played the set. Apparently people liked it. And the next day we got tagged like crazy on Instagram of all these live clips of us. And I was like, there you go. That alone will do so much more than if we would have put a song out already. That was 2-3 months away from us putting out any music. at all. But we're a rock band, so we could actually do that. Now, if you're a, you know, if you're a pop band, or if you're a pop artist, that kind of thing probably wouldn't work, like Rolodex of ideas of what to do necessarily, but it needs to be more creative than just putting the song out, and you just need to be able to rally everyone that you know. I tell people, learn how to do press. The monthly retainers cost between $2,000 to $3,000. Most of the time when you're brand new artists, it is a waste of money. There's publicists that would argue with me, friends, and I'll take that argument, but like, if you're a brand new artist and no one's heard of you, and there's, you know, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 new songs coming out of, do you really think you have a shot at this? You don't. The odds are against you. So what do? Educate yourself. If you can educate yourself and you get ahead and you still are able to get decent press, maybe not the big ass press that you wanted, then that's great. Cause like that sets you up better for the next release. And that's what you have to take every release as, is like an opportunity to learn and grow and network. And you have to network. All these pop artists who are successful right now are being lifted by their communities. Without their friends, they would have never gone to where they are. Guarantee you, because no one would have rallied and no one would have heard. That's what you got to do. You got to embrace the community. You can't be an isolationist. You can't be thinking that you're better than everyone. You have to, what I love about, you know, my friends and music scene, like everyone we've played shows with in that first year, our friends, like Liv Slingerlin, who plays a little Rodriguez band, actually. You kind of have to embrace your scene. From there, it's kind of it's a matter of if people really respond to it. And, you know, obviously, I don't recommend paying for playlisting. It's just kind of the roll of the dice half the time. But you need to get people to add your songs to as many playlists as possible. And, you know, and just kind of go through those motions. But as much advice as I can give, because from there, that's where everything is for everyone.
Totally. No, I appreciate you delving into that. And it is interesting you mentioned that's like the traditional route. And then there's TikTok, which I had the opportunity to talk to a gentleman from Atlantic. And he was like, yeah, we have a whole TikTok division now, which is interesting. He was like, it's a whole new thing. And he was, I think he said something along the lines of, we don't even fully understand it, but we're dedicating a ton of resources to it in hopes of one day cracking it.
I mean, that's what everyone's doing right now. It's the Wild West. Knows, yeah, how this is supposed to roll out. No, there's very little data, so that's why they have a whole division, because they need to all catch up. There's artists that went from TikTok to being legitimate artists that are great, that are awesome. Mm-hmm. And that's that harkens all the way to Big, harkens all the way back to Justin Bieber doing covers on YouTube. But there are legitimate artists on TikTok, and it is a very, very useful tool, and it's honestly the most creative tool that anyone could express themselves. And I think it's a good thing that it's around, because the music industry needs a shake up every 5 years, and this is what it's doing.
Are you looking at TikTok as more of an avenue for your launching existing songs or catalogs that you've got, or promoting those, I should say, or are you also looking at it as an opportunity to discover talent?
We as a publishing company don't really utilize TikTok in a certain way. You know, I think that our only connection with TikTok is obviously like, if our artists are releasing stuff, and then yes, they're involved in TikTok, and like, but for the most part, TikTok is a useful tool that, to be honest, is something that is very specific to the artist. So like the publishing doesn't really have any, what was the first part of your question?
Is it more of a medium to promote those songs, or are you looking at it as an A&R opportunity as well?
Yeah, so discovery is, yeah, it's great. It is totally great for discovery. I mean, that's what all the labels are used for anyways, right? So naturally, like, but we're all using it to discover things, discover new people, discover new profiles, discover new trends, songs. Like, it's pretty much what it all is. So it is, to me, it's a very useful as an A&R. Obviously, it's weird to say like, oh, I put in like 30 minutes to look on TikTok for my job. But like, sometimes I kind of do. Honestly, it helps some of our artists and writers that in a way that maybe they haven't seen before. And it's my job to be involved creatively. So
this is fascinating, because you've got all this like back end knowledge and whatnot. And then you mention your band that's come together as an amalgamation of different bands. Do you enjoy being able to apply that to Cuffed Up?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm constantly becoming a better songwriter because of my writer. So like there's this really crazy, interesting thing where it's kind of feeding into each other, where I've become even more empathetic to my artists and my writers and producers because, you know, I've experienced the failures and past failures and stuff, but like now, like being actively in a project where I have to, you know, marry my emotional connection to the actual art and then seeing it get thrown into the world. The way I describe it is like I'm throwing my baby out the plane and I'm hoping, you know, certain people are promising to catch it.
Yeah.
That's what it is. That's what every Thursday or Friday feels like for every fucking artist, is that someone threw the baby out the plane and then you have no control over it. It's just you're hoping it catches it. And then if it doesn't land, if it doesn't get on a playlist, if it doesn't get enough plays that you were hoping to, it felt like no one caught it and then it's dead, right? And it's kind of a morbid thing to say, but like that's what it feels like. Dramatically, that's what it feels like to a creator like myself. And now I empathetically understand that with anyone who puts out music. And that's, I think that's the thing that's like really giving me pause and empathy towards my our own artists that we represent, and then even that, or even our producers who have all these mini babies that are coming out, and like, you know, even if it's not necessarily, you know, they're not the artist, but like they have a stake in the song because they creatively put their heart and soul into it. And and being in a band has just really kind of put a lot of things into perspective. And then on the band side, I'm able to kind of really bring my expertise. Like I managed our band for the first, So our first show, this is like a really good study, is like a case study. Our first show was April of 2019. And then by November, we were signed to Rock Nation for management.
Wow.
And that was the time, and I started managing, you know, we started the band January 2019, but then I started to already methodically figure out the plan. Obviously, we made a pact. We're like, hey, this is just an excuse to hang out. We like hanging out with each other. Let's remember this is for fun. This is just a good time. But with all this music knowledge, wanted to really kind of just put my experience behind it and just see what happens.
Right.
You know, that was why we had the secret mystery show that started it all off. That's why we started playing some, you know, we played selective local shows. But and then when we had the first two songs in our chamber, I was like, all right, let's go. And I started just cold emailing and like reaching out to people. And like, that's how we got KXP Song of the Day. We got on KXP. The KXP started playing us. We're like, this is nuts. KCRW started playing us. Like, this is nuts. And then because of that, that led to getting all this attention, getting better shows, and then eventually, you know, our manager finding us. And our manager found us because I cold emailed and just be like, hey, you know, like, if you like the song, let us know. Like, we're just doing stuff. And I honestly wasn't really necessarily trying to find a manager. And we were just kind of, you know, it was just one of those thoughts where I was like, hey, I could send this out. Why haven't I tried just sharing this with people? So I shared it with just a lot of people I know in the industry, where I was like, hey, I'm in this band. I'm not sure if you know, but I'm in this band. Let me know what you think. And people generally liked it. I was like, oh, cool. That was awesome. And so because of all of that, that just eventually turned into us happening to end up getting like a manager, which is really cool. And at that time, it was cool because we had a DIY tour booked. We booked it ourselves and we're going on the road. Fuck it, we're gonna go on the road. And we played all these random places, real venues and then not so real venues. We played a house show where everyone was like doing drugs and dabs and like, you know, in the middle of, like, it was crazy. We had the most insane first tour ever, but like we knew that we wanted to cut our teeth and improve ourselves, and we're, you know, we're a post-punk band. We belong in those like hot and sweaty places.
For sure. Well, and it's awesome to see too, because going from that to playing the Crocodile in Seattle, like that's where I'm located at. So it was really cool to hear you talk through that and go from, hey, we put a surprise show together, now we're signed to Rock Nation management, and that should be an incredible new venue. That I haven't been to the new stuff yet. I'm actually not sure if they've started shows just yet. I know in the fall.
They haven't started yet, and I read about like the new location, so we're all super stoked. Sapphire in the band, she's from Seattle.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, so she grew up in Seattle, and I've been going to Seattle for years. I've had friends there for a long time, and I've always had a very soft spot for that place. So, and KXP is like, you know, is such a big holy grail to me. And John Richards has been, it's always like a pinch me moment where whenever he plays our song or any of our songs, we're just like, man, John has been one of my favorite DJs and tastemakers on this planet. He's the one who showed me, he's the one who started playing bands that influenced this band. Yeah, he's the reason why I started this band in a lot of ways. So it kind of comes full circle, and us being able to go up there and play a proper Seattle. We played one Seattle show on that DIY tour at that like creative arts space that's near like the Space Needle.
Oh, Vera Project.
Yeah, Vera Project. Yeah, nice. And they were so nice to us. But coming back to play, you know, with the Joy Formidable and then playing like a proper venue, I think it's going to be really awesome.
Yeah, that's super exciting. I definitely want to roll through for that if I can, because that's, yeah.
I forgot that you lived up there. Hit me up, because I'll get you on the list. I want you to come out.
Oh, sweet, man. Yeah, I definitely will.
First one, buy the ticket. Yeah.
So I guess going into that, before I let you go, I'd love to kind of hear about some of these influences. I know that we talked pre-podcast about that a little bit, but you've now kind of mentioned KXP's role, and I guess this starting out as a fairly localized podcast to begin, KXP obviously being one of the cornerstones of the local scene, and of course it goes far beyond that.
Yeah.
But do you mind walking me through a little bit of, I guess, how this band, we've talked about how it came together, but I guess what's kind of the amalgamation of influences going into this, and what are you, you know, kind of hoping for in the coming years?
Yeah, I mean, influence-wise, you know, the house that built everything was my love for Death Cab for Cutie, so mm-hmm. that is, you know, Seattle. There's yep. more Seattle. if there could be more Seattle. Yeah, and, you know, like, Ben Gibbard's songwriting is such a big influence on me when I was growing up, and when I got my first guitar, that the first song that I ever really learned and put effort into was like Crooked Teeth, you know, off of Plans. And then eventually I went back from there and I started, you know, listening to Transatlanticism, which blew my mind, which is still one of my favorite albums of all time. But that was huge. So, my foundational stuff was there, but before that, you know, my upbringing was so R&B heavy. Like, I grew up in the Bay Area, and I listened to so much like TLC, Outkast, Aaliyah. Like, Aaliyah is one of my favorite artists of all time. But like all this R&B pop music, it was kind of what started really making me interested in music. And before that, my dad would play a lot of light rock, less talk, you know, radio stations. So it was a lot of Vanessa Williams and Phil Collins, Genesis, like very soft, very, very soft rock.
Right.
And then it changed drastically when I discovered like Blink-182, Sum 41, Good Charlotte. And then in high school, it was just, you know, I lived in the heyday of MySpace. So it was, I really loved this band called Acceptance. That was around, that are around again, I guess. But like Acceptance was a big one. Just, you know, obviously like the first Fall Out Boy record was huge mm-hmm. for Take This to Your Grave, the first Paramore record. So I went through all those angsty times, and then eventually I discovered Radiohead, and that blew my mind. And I was like, holy shit, this is insane. And then at some point I was on tour with Radiohead, actually. I was on tour when I was with the opening band, Other Lives. I was driving their van, and I was with them on tour helping them out. And I was, oh my God, the first date was at Key Arena.
Was it really?
Which is not Key Arena anymore, but like,
yeah,
it was a big moment because we pulled up backstage and we're like, cool. And then I walked into Key Arena, and then Radiohead was like sound checking, and and me and my friend Jake Whitener, who's actually now I think the head of A&R Matador, me and him were on that trip together. So we sat in an empty arena. Tom York was like, let's try that old one. And then they start playing Planetelex, and we just blew our fucking mind. We're like, we're witnessing Radiohead play Planetelex to an empty arena, just the two of us. And we're like, this, nothing's gonna beat this moment in our life. The most insane moment. But that's why also, you know, there's a lot of that. I used to be the publicist for Deep Sea Diver, I used to do her Brian Jen Appleby, Pickwick, Barcelona. So all these like very, very Seattle. Yeah. And then the Head and the Heart crew too. Like I got to know. I think I stayed at the famous Red House for a couple of times way back when they used to have it. And, but yeah, so Seattle is such a beautiful place. And Radiohead was a big influence for me. So to me, like that was the biggest turning point on influences. And then that led to me listening to like Sgt. Pepper for the first time. And sadly it took a second for me to like discover, you know, like a lot of the Beatles discography that I didn't know apart from like the most popular songs. But then like, man, it was like a wave. It was a tidal wave. And then eventually like the biggest turning point for me was when I listened to the Pixies. Like listening to the Pixies and being like, whoa, that's right, this band's fucking amazing. This, the way he sings, like he's so aggressive, but then he's like using these full barred chords and like, and everything is so nuanced but so specific. And then, you know, and then eventually I discovered like Sunny Day Real Estate, which is, you know, that first record is still one of my favorite records of all time. And it's beautiful. It's just and post-punk music is necessary. You know, was necessary back then, but was very necessary when we started, because we were in under that administration and there was this crazy, you know, stressful time in this country. And that's why bands like Shame and Idols and Fontaine's DC became popular. It was because they were dealing with their own stuff, you know, over at the UK. And it's punk music is cyclical, you know, post-punk is cyclical. But yeah, so that's the main influences. And then nowadays I tell people all the time, like, you know, I'm going to admit it. Like a lot of my songwriting still comes back down to my R&B roots. Like I listen to that music all the time, and it shows, subtly shows. Not a lot of people will ever notice at face value because we're a post-punk band, but like, to me, it's obvious. So it's
great. Yeah. That's that secret ingredient though. You know, there's so many people that will say like, hey, I'm coming in, I'm doing a post-punk band, but if you've got that like secret ingredient of like post-punk, but I'm really me dropping a lot of R&B in here, you know what I mean? That's like the,
I mean, Alex Turner was talking about AM, right, their biggest album of all time for Arctic Monkeys. He was like, he only referenced R&B songs the whole time. He was like, I was like yeah, that's exactly what it is. But everyone, that's the beauty about music, is that everyone has such a specific background. They're bringing in their own filter to it. That's what I love about Cuffed Up, is that we all have very specific off different types of filters. Me and Sapphire are in love with this band called Fools that we've loved for a long time. They're English, you know, kind of mathy, turned into like a full on rock band. But then like Joe, the drummer, is really into jazz and funk, and like listens to a lot of, you know, different types of like world music. And then Vic comes from the hardcore punk scene, you know, where he literally played in all the hardcore punk bands you've ever heard of. And us coming together, it's such a weird, awesome thing to say, but like we, you know, our dynamics and these filters together has created something that it's really special. And yeah, and you know, everyone's really good at what they play, so it's like everyone firing on all cylinders. Sapphire literally is one of the best guitar players on this planet, and then, you know, I like writing music and coming up with poetics, and then Joe and Vic are the most talented rhythm section ever, so it's great.
That's awesome. Well, for folks that aren't familiar, I'll be linking to all this stuff for sure when this drops. I'm super excited for you, and I appreciate you taking this time. And I guess before I let you go, I kind of have like this rapid fire section, if you will, where I attempt to stump you. You already answered my first one, which was gonna be Plans or Transatlanticism, and it went with the latter.
I mean, Plans is my introduction, but Transatlanticism is the best Death Cab album of all time.
I have to agree with that. I discovered Transatlanticism because my seventh grade math teacher would always whistle it. And then one day he kept whistling.
Transatlanticism? No way. That's awesome.
Well, so not transatlanticism itself, but.
Unsettling?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And so he would always, and eventually we're just like, what are you whistling? And then he played us the record. And then I went home. I was like, Mom, Dad, there's this record I need to go get. Which, funny enough, they accidentally bought Plans instead of Transatlanticism. I was like, this is what I wanted, but this is also fantastic. And then I worked my way back to Transatlanticism.
I forgot to mention, me and Joe met because we started a Death Cab for Cutie cover band.
Joe Pepe?
No. Sorry. Joe Liptock.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. I mean, Joe Pepe is amazing.
Well, so on that note, Soul Meets Body or Crooked Teeth?
Oh, yeah. Crooked Teeth. To me, Crooked Teeth is a... I don't know. Crooked Teeth is a better song to me. Don't come at me, but Soul Meets Body, I would argue to say, is my least favorite Death Cab song.
The whole catalog, that is a hot take. I was with you with Crooked Teeth. Worst song, I'm like, all right, we'll table it.
absolute worst song, but it's definitely not in my top 20.
That's wow. For sure. Interesting. Blink 182 or Sum 41?
Oh, Blink. Blink 182 is... Sum 41 obviously is very great, but like Blink 182 is the epitome of like what changed a lot, pretty much all of our lives at some point.
Right.
You know? You're at the right age and you hear it and you're like, wow, this is kind of, you know, this is kind of cool. This is a little vulgar. This is like, there's a little undertone behind it that says fuck you, and you just connect to it, and it's very special. And you know, their live shows weren't like amazing, but like the songs in itself were just life changing.
Right.
You know?
Aaliyah or TLC?
Oh, well, TLC obviously huge influence, and I love TLC, but Aaliyah is queen, and it's just a lot of, you know, it's a lot of what ifs too, because like obviously she put out so many amazing songs, but you know, as always, it's kind of the Kurt Cobain thing where I'm like, what could have happened?
Yeah. You know? And then curveball, directing or screenwriting?
Oh, screenwriting.
Nice.
directing is great, and I will direct and I will keep directing, but there's something magical about screenwriting that is so great, because like you're building this world from nothing. Well, directors are doing that too, but like it's literally just up to you.
Mm-hmm.
It's not this big collaboration between, because directing is a collaboration between like all departments. Screenwriting is like you're sitting down on a blank page, and the universe and the creative gods are like, you know, what do you want to write about? And then you have to figure out and translate the special important thing in your life that you need to write about that no one else could write about. And
for sure.
And screenwriting has honestly made me a better songwriter too.
I believe that.
Yeah, it's just, you have to pay attention more to detail and how everything affects things. Cause in a screenplay, the stuff in act one could fuck up things in act three and vice versa. And then act two could be complete mess, and you have to go in like a doctor and fix it up. And that's kind of what writing is too.
Definitely. You've been in every facet. Why do you work in music?
Because I don't know, music is like breathing to me. Music's life. Music is life. It's everything around us. It's the things that affect us the most. That's why songs, you know, I think the biggest realization I had was in college when I had to do this report about how music affected people physiologically.
Mm-hmm.
And story about like how someone heard Fleetwood Mac kissing their, you know, the love of their life for the first time, and then that sadly that person passed away in their lives, and then they heard it for the first time in a long time, and there was this physiological thing that just like made them feel and start like bursting out crying, but like made their whole body feel in this way that like nothing could ever make them feel. I'm like, now that's magic.
Mm-hmm.
Something special. You try to find anything else in this world that could do that by just listening to something, it's undescribable. It's something, it's pure, it's just pure magic. And the brain already is such a complicated thing that if there's some avenue, like, you know, special ability that make our minds do that, I think it means that it is very special. So that's why music equals breathing. That's the reason why I do it.
I guess on the flip side, what do you hope that people working with you get out of that experience in any facet of all the projects you've got going on?
Yeah, my biggest thing is that I want everyone to, you know, walk down their careers with a level of empathy and a level of humility. And also, you know, also I want them to be able to keep their morals. And that's a weird thing to say, but like being in this business for 15, 16 years, I've seen a lot of you know, I've seen a lot of really bad shit happen, and I am the result of a lot of sketchy bad shit that's happened to me too. And to me, the thing I tell any intern that's ever worked for me, or anyone that's ever worked for me, or, you know, close friends or younger people who ask me for advice, I tell them, hold on to your morals, stick to your morals, be a good person, and that will all, everything that you want will eventually come to you, because A, you're never going to give up. So that's the second thing. Never give up. Hold your morals. If you hold on to both things, amazing things will eventually happen to you. Maybe it's not on the timeline that you wish. Maybe you're in your 20s and you think that life's over because you didn't become successful by 25. But I tell you, if you never give up, and but if you and that's the same thoughts came through my head too. But, you know, having perspective now and having some version of success now at 31 has made me realize, like, you just need to be you. You got to be you. You have to treat other people the way that you want to be treated. And sadly, I think that would be a no brainer. But like, even the other day, I heard from one of my writers that an A&R who's like the head of creative at a publishing company that I know literally told my fucking producer that, you know, a monkey could do his job.
Wow. Jeez. Like,
are you fucking kidding me? That still exists. Like, that old guard is supposed to be getting traded out right now. That's why we're all, you know, us people in our 30s are there to trade those people out who are thinking in that toxic way. And that person is kind of around our age. So I was like, wow, I guess it's just, you know, this big ego selfish game is constantly just always going to be a problem. But that's why I tell people all the time, you just keep your morals. If I pull a string for you, you only have to do one thing for me. Keep your morals.
I love that.
That's the advice that I wish everyone would take, but, you know, it's a very slippery, crazy industry, and you just kind of have to wade through all the ups and downs.
For sure. Thank you so much for taking this time. Couldn't think of a more beautiful note to end it on. So I will be sure to be pumping all socials when y'all come to town. Thank you so much again for taking this time. Genuinely appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much, Duncan. This is a great opportunity, and I love what you're doing with the podcast. You got to keep it going. I feel like this is very, very good. I'm not tooting my own horn, but like in just general, it's good for everyone to have and listen to these different perspectives, because the industry is vast and everyone has very, very different experiences. So
for sure. Well, I appreciate that, and well, yeah, we'll keep pushing.
Thanks, man.
Cheers. Huge shout out to Ralph for being on Made for Music. Really love that we've been able to dive deeper and deeper into the publishing side of things these past few weeks. So shouts out to the folks over at Angry Mob for being on Made for Music. Also, be sure to get your tickets to Cuffed Up at the Crocodile Friday, November 26th. They'll be here with the Joy Formidable. And as always, if you dig what you hear, please rate and subscribe to Made for Music on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever your preferred podcast listening site is. Genuinely appreciate that extra effort, and I will see y'all next time.